Hello and welcome to Q&A 19, everybody. We are live. Woo. We're on YouTube. Hello to the YouTube people, patrons and non-patrons alike, joining hands and celebrating the fact that only patrons could ask us questions on Patreon. So that's but we all get to hear the answers. So that how's it going, Andrew?
It is going fantastically well. Andrea Singletary asks, "What's Thomas drinking?" So I am curious about that one.
A little bit of hydrogen, a little bit of oxygen, in a combination that only—it's a proprietary combination. I'm not going to reveal the exact amount of each.
Little dihydrogen monoxide.
Yeah. Well, you just gave away my trade secret. Great. Oh, there goes my business idea.
Oh, jeez.
Yes. It's two hydrogen for every oxygen. The recipe's out now. I guess everybody can make it. I almost got a drink but I'm always at a disadvantage because it's, of course, 3 hours earlier here. I'm back in time.
Yeah, it's like early afternoon for you. So I get why you don't want to be quite the degenerate that I am.
Yeah,
so.
Tuesdays are also our bar trivia night, and I save my calories for that. Like, I want to wait, you know what I mean? I got to save my drinks and my calories for later. Otherwise, it's just a little too much, so... I'm sober as a stone cold sober, so I'll handle all the legal questions. Andrew can't, so I'll no. I'm just
okay.
Kidding. You'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, this ounce of Ardbeg is clearly going to interfere with analysis skills.
You staggering drunk would still be a better lawyer than me, as sober as I've ever been. So that's how we do.
I think it might be better than Roger Stone's lawyers, but.
Oh man. All right. We can go to the question thread.
And yeah, let's do it. Let's get this show on the road.
Ooh, hold on. Sorry. I've got this. Can I close this window? There we go. I had our video. It was messing me up. All right. We like to start, of course, as always, with Teresa Gomez, who's the first on the scene every time. And I think even though, you know, this one didn't get a ton of hearts, sorry, Teresa, but you know, it's first, it's tradition. I think we should start with her question.
Not heart up Teresa Gomez? She's just the best.
Would you rather have a cat with a human face or a dog with human hands instead of paws? I think I see why that didn't get as many hearts as maybe the last time.
Yeah, I could see that.
Either thing is horrifying?
Yeah, those are both horrible. There is, I'm going to give the best serious answer/non-answer I can to this question, which is I read one of the things that I always try and read every year is Gardner Dozois's the year's best science fiction compendium. It's at like volume 37, 38. So it's a collection of short stories, which is good because I don't get a huge ton of time to read fiction. So, and there is a really, really moving and horrible story about dogs being genetically engineered for super intelligence and to talk in that collection. So if you like science fiction at all, and or if you are a dog lover at all, I highly recommend pick up the year's best science fiction from 2018 and read that dog story and tell me you don't cry. It is totally it's totally sad.
Answer the question. Would you Your Honor, the witness is refusing to answer the question. Permission to treat Andrew Torres as hostile.
All right. You can treat me as hostile, which means you get to ask me leading questions now. I would obviously take the dog. I would take any dog over any cat. I think pretty much. But there we
Sean
go.
Sean Latimer, nice one in the chat. I don't have a lot of time to read fiction. Fiction proceeds to read Larry Klayman filings.
Thanks. Good job, Sean. Yeah.
All right, let's get to our first real question here.
Real question.
No offense, Teresa, but I'm horrified by both those options, and I'd rather not ponder them. I guess it doesn't matter how I say it because it's an anagram. Guess what? Record spent a lot champion is an anagram of top patron Conrad Michaels. In OA 243, you mentioned that Oliver Wendell Holmes is synonymous with legal brilliance. What, in your opinion, is legal brilliance? What makes one jurist massively more profound than another?
Wow. Boy, that's a great question. I've never really thought about it before. I think what I would say that defines legal brilliance is the ability to communicate your position to somebody that doesn't share that worldview or perspective on things. Mm. Right. And so, you know, so one of the things that was really, really a big kind of minor movement among conservatives when I was in law school was the law and economics movement. I've alluded to this a little bit. Richard Posner was the of the Seventh Circuit was the sort of leading light, and he was the chief villain for liberals back when I was in law school. Right, like, I mean, we knew Scalia was terrible, but like Scalia was a nut, and everybody thought like the law and econ approach was about to be sort of where conservative jurisprudence was going. So, you know, when I think about people who take the law and make it transformative, that's to me, that's where sort of legal brilliance comes in, right?
Like, yeah, I kind of want to push you a little bit on this because I'm curious. It almost seems like when we think of who are the great justices or whatever of all time, it's like, is there a bias in there of like, okay, who found a way to make the law and the Constitution and all the precedent bend into not horrible things? Because like you look, you know, 150 years ago or whatever, it might have been the case that the current jurisprudence or the current constitutional understanding allowed things like slavery and allowed awful things. So is that part of it? And as a follow-up to that, is there a conservative justice ever that you would say, oh, that's a great jurist, but it, you know, not someone I agree with kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, look, like, I mean, let's go back to Scalia, right? Like this was how you and I met. Rain was
dancing on folks, Scalia's grave.
Yeah. So folks who don't know the story, on Thomas's earlier show, the predecessor to Serious Inquiries Only, Atheistically Speaking, I was a fan of the show. And he, I don't even remember the episode you had, but you had a good guest. And I wrote you an email and I said, hey, this was a great like hour-long interview up until the last 10 minutes when the guests started pontificating.
No, I think I had a bad guest, actually. I believe it was an anti-abortion person.
Mm.
I don't think it was a good guest.
Well, it was a good discussion.
Sure, yeah.
And I said it was great. I really enjoyed it up until the end where, you know, there was this legal thing that kind of went off the rails. And instead of you telling me to go fuck myself, you wrote back and you were like, oh, no, thanks for writing in. And then like a week later, Scalia died and you emailed me and were like, hey, would you like to come on my show and talk shit about Scalia? And I said, would I? And and that was it. And a friendship was born. A podcast was born. But we fundamentally disagree. Like I believe that Antonin Scalia is brilliant but evil. And I would say that his skill in really transforming how jurisprudence gets done falls into that category.
You know, I think you're right. It's not so much a difference between is he brilliant or not. It was more like how do we define someone being brilliant? So like if someone is super smart, but they utilize that brain power to, you know, have an amazing cognitive dissonance that allows them to come to really dumb conclusions. Like it's more on the definition of like, if stupid is as stupid does kind of thing. But no, I agree with you that of course he was smarter than I'll ever be. It's just frustrating.
But he's also kind of a tragic hero, right? In the sense that like one of his defining characteristics was sarcasm in his opinions, yeah. Right? Which
turned into later conservative jurisprudence. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, no. Which turned into legal exceptions, right? So, for example, like in Lawrence v. Texas, which was the decision that overturned Texas's sodomy laws, right? Scalia, in dissent, bitterly was like, well, if this is where the Supreme Court is going, then I don't see why gays aren't going to get married and cats and dogs will be living together. And, you know, it'll be mass hysteria. And the majority in Obergefell cited Scalia's dissent, right, for part of that. Same thing with the Fourth Circuit in Colby versus Hogan, right? Right. He said, well, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, militia weapons, you know, we're not talking about, you know, regulating military weapons. And that was the hook that the Fourth Circuit used to say, yeah, look, even the Supreme Court thinks that the Second Amendment doesn't cover, you know, regulating militia style weapons. So, you know, that I mean that tragic hero in the literary sense, but, yeah. But it really did, you know, provide ways to kind of undermine what he's done. And as we talked about on today's show, right, you now have the activist right-wing Supreme Court looking to undo what I would argue is one of the cornerstones of Scalia's legacy, right, which is the Employment Division versus Smith case. So,
yeah, and oh, you just reminded me with the episode out today. Also, Lot Awful Movies going up very soon. Everybody check that out. It's a lot of fun. It was one of the most pointless movies ever, but we can find entertainment in pointlessness and legal nonsense.
People like this. We can tell. Look, you know, if you show up for the Q&A, we will tell you. We did. We went back to our roots. We went to a John Grisham movie. We watched The Client, which was 103 hours long. And people like this movie, and I and none wrong. Of us. We had Sam on. I love having Sam on, and I can't. What in the hell? If you liked The Client, right, before so you bad. Hear Lot Awful Movies, right, send us an email and tell us what you liked about this. Because as a movie, I can't figure it out, right? Like, if I were a bricklayer, I would be like, there are no fucking stakes to this movie, right? Like, we follow around Brad Renfro and he and Susan Sarandon split a cigarette. And then,
I mean, you do get to see a man wearing a mesh see-through thing. Top
volleyball uniform
with a sword earring. Yeah. Anyway. All right. We got to get to our next question by George yes. Reinhardt. This has a lot of hearts, so ooh. I got to ask it, but I imagine it could be one of those boring answers. We'll see. What's the legal basis for gas stations advertising 0.9 cents in their prices when they cannot possibly accept that amount? any ideas?
So, I mean, there's not really a legal reason. It's a marketing reason, right? So when it's $1.99 and 0.9 cents, it's really $2. And there's nothing, right? Like, people buy multiple quantities of the thing, so you can build in like a fractional cent.
It is weird to charge a thing that doesn't exist. Like, I see what you're saying, yeah. And effectively it just – you do the math and then round it. But, like, it is weird to charge an amount that's not currency. Like, we don't have 0.9 cent pieces.
I mean, to me, what's weird about that is that the practice became enshrined, like, 100 years before credit cards and computers, right? Because right now, that's totally – like, if I am a supplier, right, I do this in contracts all the time, right? Like, I can say I'm going to give you – you know, take our TTTBE, right? Like, I'm going to supply water bottles to you and you're going to pay me 4.173 cents per water bottle, right?
What if we took all those fractions of a cent and put them into an account? Oh, never mind. That's Superman 3.
Like Superman 3. By the way, I everything about Office Space is brilliant, but like the meta moment where they look at each other on the couch and are like Superman 3, that is my favorite. Because I love Superman 3. Are you with me on loving Superman 3?
I haven't seen it since I was a little kid. I don't remember.
God, those it's movies so it's really so weird. Glorious. I mean, Richard Pryor is just – he's a genius.
Yeah.
And yeah, you got to watch it. All right. It's okay. Terrible, but it's so good. All right.
This one's interesting. Greg Sullivan asks, if a family member draws a picture of, hypothetically speaking, Jesus riding a T-Rex and gives it to me, and then I provide it to a tattoo artist who then tweaks it and applies it permanently to my skin and adds a flying spaghetti monster to the artwork, who owns the copyright? How does that work?
Jesus Christ. Okay. let's parse through all of this, right? So lots of people own some segment of the intellectual property in this. Let's start off. The original picture that's drawn, the original artist owns the copyright in that. When they give that to you and say you can get a tattoo of this, right? They are surrendering part of their copyright to you, because when you create something, you own not only the thing that you created, but you own all of what are called derivative rights to that, right? And the super easy way to think about that is that's why George R.R. Martin is making a shit ton of money off of the HBO Game of Thrones, right? Like, he wrote the books, he has written portions, but not all of the screenplays for HBO. But it doesn't matter, right? Like, they have to license Game of Thrones from George R.R. Martin because he owns the copyright.
Yeah, no matter how unrecognizable the actual show ends up being after the first season, still he gets the money for it.
It's still good, right? Like, you're with me that it's still good, right? Like,
I quit. I didn't watch the last season, but
The last season.
Don't tell me anything.
All right. The last season feels like.
Alice, if anyone posts spoilers, they're banned for life. Just letting everybody know.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring the hammer down, Alice.
Yep.
Look, the last season is a little bit of like we're writing against the clock. And.
Ban Andrew for life. Spoilers. All right. Let's get to it.
So, original artist owns that copyright. They have transferred it to you. Then the question is your contract with the tattoo artist, right? Because the tattoo artist is transforming that artwork in some way by adding a flying spaghetti monster to it. Mm. Under most circumstances, right, that would be, right, if I were doing your contract in this, I would specify that the tattoo artist is making a work for hire. Right. So in other words, even though they're exercising creative stuff, the stuff they're doing, they're being paid for. And so therefore the copyright would transfer along with the ink to your arm. So then you would own the combined.
So it's like if you hire a guy in a studio to record your album. He doesn't own any part of the album.
That's exactly right. Okay. Or, you know, if you're an animator for Walt Disney and you come up with a new character,
ooh,
right?
Ouch.
Yeah, 100%, right? Like, that's
you're out the billions of dollars that throughout history that was probably worth. Damn.
Yep.
That's rough.
So, that's a matter of contract.
But there's nothing that prevented. I'm curious, like, if the original person who gave the picture was like, hey, I'm mad that you added a flying spaghetti monster to my work. Would they have any claim to that? Like,
yeah, they could sue you for copyright infringement. Yep.
Get laser removal?
What they can get is money. Right?
Oh, okay.
And so if they can prove the Copyright Act, some of you who may be fans.
Or you become their butler or no, just money. Okay, just money.
Some of you who may be fans of another podcast for whom I serve as general counsel may know this story. But if you intentionally infringe on the copyright of another and redistribute it without permission, you get statutory damages that range from $30,000 to $150,000 per infringement. So, yeah.
Be careful with your tattoos, everybody. Jeez. Yeah. All right. Ben has a great question here. This is a little rose colored glasses. So I, you know, knock on wood here, but if and when Trump gets ousted by blank box woman in 2020 and gets convicted of multiple serious federal crimes, would there be anything special about how he could be sent to rot and die in prison? Would he be just thrown in any old jail like any other criminal? Would he retain? Oh, this one I think you've touched on before, but just for fun, in case anybody new is listening, would he retain his right to Secret Service in jail? A very interesting question. So what do you think? How does that work? Would he just go to any old prison?
Wow. Well, so. Let me filibuster this for a little bit first. Can I say that I love the fact that the three leading Democratic candidates for president in 2020, if you were to handicap them right now, I would say are Liz
Joe
Warren.
Biden, Bernie Sanders. I could tell you were going to name the women, but unfortunately, I don't think the polls back you up. But that's okay.
But I'm not looking at polls because polls are garbage at this stage. Right? They're literally just a function of name recognition. The three that have the best infrastructure and all of the underlying data that would support being a strong candidate are, and I think in this order, Liz Warren, Kamala Harris, and Kirsten Gillibrand. And I love that. I think that is fantastic. It makes me sad because Chris Christofko, who picked first in our fantasy draft, got Liz Warren in round one and then Sherrod Brown at the turn in either round two or three.
Good value pick there.
And I really think if you told me, right, if you're betting the exacta, I'm going to go with Liz Warren, Sherrod Brown. Like, that just strikes me as the most likely pairing for the 2020 Democratic ticket. Anyway, I don't really know the answer to that question, and I cannot imagine.
That's interesting. Yeah. I thought you talked about the Secret Service thing before. I guess.
He will retain his Secret Service detail, right? Like that's.
But in prison.
Yeah, that's a perquisite of being the.
So some poor Secret Service employee is like, well, I guess you're in prison now. You have to go.
Yeah, he's going to get pardoned. So
his duty. But pretend we live in a just society for a minute.
Well, that would be fun. Can we go back and arrest Condoleezza Rice for
Secret
war
Service
crimes?
member job be like, all right, we've done some research. You want to join this prison gang. This will keep you safer than the other. That's the kind of work they'll have to do.
I strongly believe that because the Secret Service right is contractual. And so the prison environment would take precedence over your contractual right to the Secret Service. So so no, he will not be lifting weights in the supermax prison outdoor courtyard with a bevy of Secret Service agents around him. Side question, the Secret Service has to take a bullet for the president. There's no way the Secret Service can stand Donald Trump, is there? Right? They just had to work without pay for several weeks. I get that they're all professionals and you do your job, but if you pulled them aside and put them under the liar, liar, truth serum, they'd have to be I hate that guy, right?
I know. I definitely, if I were the Secret Service agent, and that's of course, what happens is the person points the laser that they have for no reason to indicate where they're going to shoot, and the laser goes on Trump's chest, and then the Secret Service man's doing the take the bullet for him. I would do is be like oh my ankle, oh no, and then fall just short, I was gonna do it, man, I twisted my ankle on a root in the sidewalk, sorry. And then that would be I'm still gonna pretend like I'm gonna do it, but I would find a way to be blameless in the situation.
I think that's exactly right.
All right. Bird Lawyer Esquire asks, two Federalist Society judges recently suggested abolishing discovery for all cases worth less than $500,000. Would this accomplish anything or just screw poor people?
Holy fuck. Jesus Christ, is that evil?
Yeah, was Wilbur Ross in charge of this?
I haven't heard of this. Thanks for bringing it to my attention, Bird Lawyer. That is just seriously, that is a combination of snidely whiplash, mustache twirling, Dr. Claw petting the cat,
Through what the effect of that would
be. Okay, so here's what the effect of that would be, right? First, parenthetically, it is trying to solve a problem by attacking what isn't the problem, right? So the reason why, I've said this before, but I will say it again, the reason why courts are overcrowded everything in the law takes a long time is when one giant corporation sues another giant corporation over $100 million. I know, because I did those cases for 15 years. And what happens is, yes, ultimately even a lot of them settle. But you get to a point where and you do that because, you know, you litigate it out for years and years. And you get to a point where either everybody has the same valuation of the case or similar or they don't. And when you have huge dollar amounts that differ by orders of magnitude, you increase the chances that the parties have different views of the case. But to get to that point, right, requires tons of litigation. I've tried to point this out on the show that when you have lawsuits by like a normal plaintiff against a big corporation, right? Like that's when you'll see 274 docket entries within a year, right? Like, because that's what big law will buy you, right? When you're Lloyd's of London, you get to hire not just me, but like a team of lawyers who work around the clock. And if $1 billion is at stake, as was in some of my cases, like money is no object. Just do, you know, work 24/7, get as many associates and paralegals as you want and clog up the process. So if you care about efficiency in discovery, you should care about corporations suing each other. You should absolutely not be caring about small plaintiffs under $500,000. So now, with that as preamble, what would be the consequence? A bunch of different things. Number one, you would incentivize plaintiffs' lawyers to increase their demand to $500,000 in every single case, right? So the analog to that is in order to get federal jurisdiction, we talked about diversity. You have to have complete diversity of the parties. And you also have to have $75,000 or more in case or controversy. Right. And so what that means is in every case, right, like even if I breach a contract with you for $10,000, I will sue you for a bunch of unrelated torts, right, that are that I don't have any real chance of winning on in order to increase my total demand to more than $75,000. So you're going to incentivize that. Number two, I don't know how – what you're going to do is you're going to shut the courthouse door to scores of plaintiffs that have meritorious cases, right? Like, I'm struggling for words here, but discovery is how you litigate, right? Like, that is – monstrous and evil and would be so. Yeah. So the net effect is if you didn't have discovery, then it would be very difficult or impossible for plaintiffs in virtually every case that affects real people to prove their cases. And so those cases would then be subject to early motions for summary judgment, and the entirety of the courts would be transformed into an instrument to protect the ultra wealthy from modest incursions upon their wealth.
So, okay. It. So short answer, this is a bullshit crap idea and it's awful it better not happen.
It is layers. It is fractally evil. I haven't heard of this before. It is one of those things. This is now officially like the worst thing I've heard anybody ever propose.
Stormy Decisis would sue you for $1,000 damages, $499,000 for beard fees.
nice. Oh, wow, I can see a good half mil because I'm feeling good about the beard.
That's a great beard you got going. Thomas was right, everybody. That's probably of all the things, my ultimate Thomas was right was, Andrew, you should grow a beard.
Oh, man.
You're welcome.
I'm loving
You're
it.
Welcome, everybody. All right. This one's interesting. I think this is probably one of the most difficult things for humans to do, I think. I strongly believe this. And I think even you and I will have a hard time doing it, trying as we might to be unbiased and all that. But Jurisprudence Falsely So-Called asks, looking back to your thoughts when Trump was elected, what has most surprised you? And I say that's really difficult because I think we update, you know, a kind of we forget what we used to think. I think humans, it's one of those cognitive shortcomings we all have, is like we forget what we were thinking at a time and we kind of update our memories in a way that's not entirely, loyal to the truth. You know, that's not entirely how it was. So I'm having a hard time thinking of something. Do you have anything that jumps to mind?
Oh, I, yeah, good. I'm glad you tackled it first. Yeah. So there are two things that really come to mind, one is procedural and one is substantive. The procedural one is, I've talked about this before as sort of being the genesis for, the hashtag clear as Kushner. It is clear to me that what happened when Donald Trump, got into office was, he pulled his advisors around and said, I want to have Jared Kushner be on the White House, staff. And everybody said, well, you know, Mr. President, that's a blatant violation of the anti-nepotism law. You can't do that. And then Donald Trump asked a question that I think nobody, including Richard Nixon, in the history of the Republic has ever asked, which was, right, I get that, but what happens to me if I don't? Yeah. And I think everyone around him was like, well, I guess they could impeach you. And Trump was like, they're not gonna impeach me over that. So, okay. And that, in my view, was the, and maybe it wasn't Jared Kushner, but to me, right, that was the first domino. But that was the start of the complete disintegration of the rule of law that we've seen from Donald Trump, of the, like, the question shifted from what does the law say the president has to do to what will happen to me if I break this law as the president? I didn't expect that because I'm naive. That's procedural. Substantively, I did not expect that Donald Trump would become – this is a two-parter. I did not expect that Donald Trump would become a wholly owned subsidiary of the religious right, and I did not expect that the entirety of the Republican Party would go along with him. That befuddles me on both scores, right? Like, I thought Trump would have to fight to be accepted by Republicans. Not the case. And I thought part of that fight meant that he would do things like actually make good on the promise for infrastructure and other things that are, iconoclastic that he campaigned on, that he seriously did campaign on. Right. I mean, obviously, lots of his campaign was just lying nonsense. But there were things that were a core part of his campaign that he promised that I thought he would fight for, and all of those went by the wayside. So those are my answers.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time thinking of what would be the most surprising. I guess the fact that – I'm so naive and optimistic, even though I don't really think of myself that way. But I still am always surprised at how completely – the right wing has been able to insulate itself from the truth. Like, it still surprises me.
Yeah.
And I don't think it will anymore. Now I'm on the opposite end of things, where I think even when the Mueller report comes out, and even if it's as bad as we expect it to be, and as rigorous as we think it might be, I don't think it'll matter. I think that it will. I don't think he'll be impeached. I don't, there might be, he might be impeached because we control the House, but he won't. I don't think he'll be convicted because I think I would say the most surprising thing is not that there was some, truth bending and some fake news like that. I knew all that existed, but just how far it can be taken, to the point where it doesn't feel like anything could not be lied away by the Fox News machine,
Well, patrons here, but in the bonus episode with Bryce, I said I think that the senator to watch for the apex of Yodel Mountain, and you can gather this from a past episode of OA, but is Richard Burr of North Carolina, who's the Republican head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who allowed. Right. Who validated the reports of our intelligence agencies that said Russia attempted to meddle in the 2016 presidential election and did so to benefit Donald Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton. And I just, again, maybe I'm really naive, but We know I'm naive in a lot of ways, but I just believe that there are Republicans who do not want to see the United States become a client state of Russia. And I there aren't enough, right? Like it should be 100% of them. And it clearly isn't. But I believe, yeah. Right. I believe that there are 20 or 30 of them. Maybe I'm wrong, but
that is another really surprising thing. Republicans turning into like the pro-Russia party. That's wow. All right. We got to move on. This one, I can't really read the patron name. Cormquest.clorp. Oh, okay. It's campquest.org. It's campquest.org, but it's cormquest.clorp, cormquest.clorp, cormquest.clorp. they ask, are some kinds of attorneys cooler than others at lawyer parties? Like pretend you, I want you to set, cause you're now a lawyer rock star. So pretend you were just back at your old firm or whatever. And you go to just an all lawyer party. Forget there's no podcast. There's no, you know, Puzzle with Thunderstorm. It's just, you're at an all the boringest lawyer party that we all imagine it is where everybody drinks an awful lot. Who are cool lawyers there? Like who would be, you know, the kind who do the kind of law where everybody's like, oh man, you got to talk to that lawyer over there. You know, that kind of thing.
Okay. I'm going to answer the question, but first I'm going to tell you a 100% real story. Okay. And that is, every year I go to my former firm's holiday party. I do this for a number of reasons. Every lawyer in Baltimore goes, right? It's where I reconnect with, you know, my judge friends and right. It's a big kind of shindig and I go to, you know, network and schmooze and catch up. But I also go for this delightful thing. And I 100%, I do this every single year on some poor unsuspecting schmuck. And what happens is like you wander around, it's all lawyers. There's nobody else there. And they will come up to you and like sort of start narrating their practice to you. Right. And they'll be like, I do third level reinsurance treaties, but I only reinsure the reinsurers of pre-1986 liabilities and only if they're asbestos and pollution.
Oh my God, I just went into a coma.
Right. And they will like narrate this to you about their practice for like 11 minutes, right? And you've got to like sit there and kind of nod along like the bird drinking water. And then they will remember at some point like a like book they read in the 1970s on like, you know, that the like Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People or whatever. And they'll be like, so what do you do? Yeah. And I will look at them square in the eye and go, I vet dick jokes for a living. And it is just like my favorite point of the entire evening. And they'll be like, and sort of stare at me. And then I'll be like, no, really. Like, I have a vibrant practice advising podcasts, how to get sued for defamation and win. It's really cool. You should. And then they'll like wander off and be like, I have an appointment way over on the other side of the room. I'm also the only person, literally it's a room of like 300 people. I'm the only person who goes, who does not wear a suit. I love being able to do that. So that's my story. Among lawyers, right, there is absolutely a pecking order, and the pecking order, and I'm embarrassed to say
this,
right?
This is gonna be
the best. The pecking order is almost entirely in order of your hourly billable rate. Right. Oh, I'm not okay. making this up, right? Like, so
makes sense.
If you come from New York or DC, right? New York lawyers look down on DC lawyers. DC lawyers look down on Baltimore lawyers, all in big law firms, right? Baltimore big law firm lawyers look down at everybody in smaller cities than that. And all of those who bill by the hour look down on anybody who bills on contingency.
Right.
And then all of those people look down on anybody who actually works to really help people. So public defenders, people who do street crime, who do DUIs, right? Like the people who do the kinds of things that your family like probably thinks about of like, oh yeah, well, I would want a lawyer if ever, you know, I accidentally had a DUI or a traffic accident or whatever. Like that – that's where it rolls the furthest downhill to. Totally unfair, but yeah. But there you go.
Yeah, that's as awful as I thought it would be. All right.
Yep.
I love this patron name. This is probably my favorite. Get me Roger Stone. No, seriously, get me Roger Stone. Mueller. Nice. Care to comment on Rudy's antics? Why is he doing that? This is an evergreen question. Could have been.
Yeah, right.
Could have been from a year ago. Could have been from yesterday. Well, who knows? Doesn't matter. Is he really just a bad lawyer, or do you think he's got something else going on? I've heard people speculate that his goal is just to sow as much confusion as possible. What do you think, Andrew Thomas? Go ahead.
So you have thought, because I have a thought, but I'm curious if you have thoughts first.
Well, I mean, I think you've mentioned the fact that, was it him who, you know, is kind of thinking about it in terms of the jury in this case is the American voter, because impeachment is the only remedy for any of this stuff kind of thing. And, but like, also he's just not good at what he does. Like, that's the other, it's not some grand strategy. I mean, he has a strategy, like there's a strategy which he has, and then there's how bad he is at doing anything. And the, you know, it's hard. I think you can't just say, like, you can't do the Trump thing and be, oh, secret genius. It's all secret genius. No, I think a good portion of it is he's nuts and just losing his mind. That's me. What do you think?
So, yeah. So here's the fact, right? The fact is that Rudy Giuliani will say things that turn out to be true in situations that are very clearly, if not a sanctionable breach of attorney-client confidentiality, a thing you shouldn't be saying about your client, right? And the clearest example is, like, we were a week into Stormy Daniels, a week into us doing Stormy Daniels, which was, you know, several months ahead of the mainstream media reporting on it. And Rudy Giuliani was the first person to say, oh, yeah, this is definitely not a campaign finance violation, because he was all paid back via retainer, right? Somebody even sent that to us, right? And I looked at that and I'm like, that makes no goddamn sense, right? Like that, and it was not until after Michael Cohen flipped, right? Like months later, when we looked at it and it was like, oh yeah, like Rudy Giuliani said the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet, right? Like he described a much worse crime than anybody was thinking at the time, right? Which is not only like illegal campaign contributions, but then the evidence that it's an illegal campaign contribution, which is you hit it by grossing it up, adding a cherry on top, and you then know, pretending like it's a
retainer. Totally right. If I had to, like, right now, if I were like Rudy's advocate trying to think what the secret genius hypothesis would be, you can make an okay case that he and Trump somehow have recognized the fact, and I think the Pod Save America people say this all the time, and I think it's absolutely true, that if the stuff that Trump has done in public, out loud, on TV, on Twitter, if that were discovered in a secret audio tape or a secret email, we would all lose our fucking minds and be like, oh my God, we found the secret tape where he says, no, Russia is a root, like whatever it is, you know. Oh, I fired Comey because I was thinking this Russia thing is a root. If we found that in a secret document, we'd be like, we got it. It's Nixon. We got it. It's the tapes. But somehow we're not, as a public, able to handle when people just do crime in the open. And I think that if the secret genius case for Giuliani would be, he just says the crimes in a nonchalant way that makes us all think, oh, well, if he's saying it, well, then it, like, subconsciously, the public is like, well, I guess that's fine then. Oh, yeah, he paid retainer. It's all fine. And it's actually a horrible crime. But when you say it in that, like, tone, then I guess the public is like, yeah, see, it's all above board.
And that is right. That's why I said, let's start with the fact, right? Like, and I could add additional, you know, evidence to that. And then the question is, right, is he saying this because it's part of, like, laying the groundwork for lowered expectations? Like, oh yeah, no, we already knew that.
Yeah.
Or is it just, you know, he has dementia? And I don't know that we have enough evidence to ascertain between the two. I will point out the fact that we cannot determine whether the president's personal lawyer is a grand strategist or is just insane.
Yeah.
Tells us the world in which we're living. But there you go.
All right.
YouTube, Remarsh3 says, I started listening to y'all due to Stormy. Thanks, nice. Remarsh. So did a lot of people. We're glad to have you, and hopefully, you've enjoyed the ride. We are planning hopefully something special for our Tuesday episode, which will be 250. Maybe, we'll go out and be able to spread the word and get some new folks in, but, you'll just have to wait for that one.
So I'm noticing the time, and I realize I want to do the thing where I scroll down to the bottom and get the more, recent questions.
Oh, yeah. Good idea.
So now, here's one from Sliced Cabbage is 9/10 of coleslaw. that's a dad joke. All right. Is Mueller's grand jury...
We're both dads, so we get to laugh.
Yeah, that works. Is Mueller's grand jury comprised of the same group of people for the entire 2 years and counting? That's interesting. Are they sequestered, deliberating things for the entire time? Are they on call? Never thought about that. How does that process work?
I have never thought about that either. So, I believe that there are different grand juries that have been impaneled for different defendants. And I think that that's required under the Sixth Amendment. We're treading on an area that is way outside my expertise. But I think that's the way it works. So you can have a single grand jury when you're talking about a consistent investigation, and most of them are not sequestered, right? So it's not a Pauly Shore movie where they're all living in the hotel for the last 2 years.
By the time this is all over, they're gonna open up a cage where all these poor people have had to be grand jurying for years and years. Sunlight, yeah. What's happening? So many crimes to evaluate.
God, could you imagine? There was a fantastically bad 1980s movie that was Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman, in which Danny DeVito was a mobster turned TV producer, and Rhea Perlman was the head number cruncher at the Nielsen ratings. And so so they found the like key families that they needed to rig in order to have his show be the most popular show on television. And then they put them all on a cruise. They got a garbage scow, and they put them all on a cruise for the weekend in order to get his show the top ratings. And then it got picked up for the season. So there was just this announcement of like, your cruise has been extended for 26 fun-filled weeks. And I just imagined that happening at the Grand Jury.
All right.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know.
So this is an area of law that you don't entirely know. Gerald Lott asks a question that it's more of a statement, but I think it might be interesting. Maybe you'll want to riff on it or something regarding the shutdown. Gerald Lott asks, did Trump shut down the government for these XX? What was it? 35, 40, 35 days? I forget. Something like that. It was over 30, I think. But anyway, however many days, without ever even vetoing a single bill.
Yeah, I think that's right, because yeah. I think McConnell did not bring – right as soon as there was the continuing resolution to fund the government for 3 weeks, that
– Yeah, it was just like a verbal shutdown.
Yeah. And again, you know, that goes to show you like if you put yourself in the mindset of taking an AP U.S. history course 50 years from now, right? Like we look back at, Daniel Webster, right? Like there are Lyndon Johnson's time as a majority leader in the Senate, right? Like there are throughout history supremely influential legislators, even though, we tend to think about eras as being defined by presidents. And Mitch McConnell has got to be considered sort of the architect of the evil of the past 5 years, right? Like beginning with just openly being like, yeah, no, we're going to steal a Supreme Court seat. And it still kind of shocks me that, that he got away with that. I don't know that anybody else would have tried. So, that is correct. Mitch McConnell did not bring up a joint continuing resolution. Trump did not veto it. And yeah, that's how we had the shutdown.
All right. Here's one I'm glad I saw. Eric the Baker says, I've been wanting to ask this question for quite a while, and this is my first chance after being a patron for over a year. Thank you. Congrats. And thank you. The dump trucks hauling crushed rock and gravel here. Oh, man, I already know where this is going. Often have the following types of signs on the back. Warning, stay back 200 feet. We are not responsible for broken windshields. The wording, as well as the distance quoted, seems to vary. I've seen included a picture. Does this type of disclaimer actually count in assuaging the trucking company, I don't think that's the right word, and driver of any damage claims someone might file against them? I've raised your hand if you've had your fucking windshield cracked by a god. Yeah. I love the idea, too, that I don't know what your answer is going to be, but if indeed a stay back 200 feet rule, like the idea that you can just put a sign and then people don't get to use the road as much, like you just decide, sorry, less road, everybody, because we don't want to be sued. Anyway, how does this work? Are they liable?
So the answer is they may well still be liable. Right. So here's what's going on. We've talked about this principle before. One of the things you learn in 1L first semester torts is there's no such thing as negligence in the air, right? Like in order to establish negligence, you have to establish that you owe a duty to the person who got hurt as a result of the thing that you did. But driving on the road, you now have a duty to the other drivers on the road, right? So I can't load up my truck to the tip top with gravel and then get on the highway and floor it, right? And start weaving between lanes.
Because I guess how different would that be than saying like, and then me just putting a sign on my car being like, everybody stay back 200 feet. If I bump into you, it's not, I have no liability.
Right.
Yeah. You should have stayed away.
Terrible, occasionally alcoholic driver on board, stay back, right? And then and then when I slam into you, it's like, wow, I told you I was a terrible, occasionally alcoholic.
Look at the sign. You got to stay away from me. Give me the whole road.
No. Assholes. But God, the reason the sign is there is to establish, right? Like that.
Can't they put a fucking top on the thing?
And the answer to that is they might have to, right? So we're talking about bringing a negligence action, right? And the way in which you determine negligence is you first say, does the defendant owe a duty of care to the plaintiff, right? So in this case, you're driving a truck full of rocks. I'm the plaintiff, the guy driving behind you. Do you owe a duty of care to me? And the answer to that is yes. And then the question is, what is that duty of care and did you abide by that, right? And so you would ask, what would a reasonable driver of a truck full of rocks do in this circumstance? And that's why you see the signs are sort of mostly the same, right? So because one of the things that a reasonable driver of a truck full of rocks would do is warn you, hey, I got a truck full of rocks here. It does not constitute, right? Like this is not the Simpsons episode where Marge opens it up and reads it and is like, gets to the bottom and is like, by reading this letter aloud, you have waived all rights in perpetuity throughout the universe. That was my Marge impression, guys.
And Marge is tough.
You can't unilaterally impose contract conditions on someone else. That is not a waiver, but it does inform the standard of care, and that's what the sound is. That's what the sign is about.
Yeah, well, that's dumber than a truck full of rocks, is I think how the saying goes.
I used to drive I-95 from my house in Montgomery County to Baltimore every single day, and my car windshield was just like a spider web of because you can't drive 45 miles on the highway every single day and not get rocks kicked up onto your.
Yeah, I've got a fresh giant. It's not broken, but it's like a. It looks like a bullet hole almost. Boy, is that an experience too? When it hits you, and it hit me, you know, right in the face, and like it's one of those things that's so startling. Your body reacts before you even know, you know. Like it was one of those where it's just like, and I was like, what? Oh yeah, and like you catch up with what happened. It was crazy. Time for, let's see, maybe one or two more here. This one I think will be more interesting to hear your answer, although I'll give mine very quickly. William Beam asks, where do you guys get your news from? I realize answering this question could be a dumpster fire, but I was curious. Thanks, hashtag Big Seltzer. What's that? I don't know what that is, but is that something?
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway. I have no idea. I am drinking a lot of the LaCroix seltzer water lately because I'm not drinking, you know, I'm not, I'm doing the sort of the low carb, no sugar thing. And that way I get something that doesn't taste like drinking either water or coffee, but I have no idea.
So, I mean, I New York Times, Washington Post, that kind of thing. I don't have anything amazing to say. So I also just peruse Google News. And then I'll see, you know what I like that Google News does is that, you know, for a given topic or headline or whatever, everybody knows this, I'm sure, but I like that it groups together all of the sources. And so like you click on the top headline and you see, you know, here's Fox News, and it's always the Fox News take is like fucking batshit, you know, it'll be like such and such. And then the Fox News one is like, well, actually Trump owned those people, you know, it's like, that's your version of that story. But anyway, it's good because you can get a feel for what the different sources are trying to say by their headline. And you can read multiple sources on a given story. So I do like that about Google News. How about you?
So I'm going to tell another story first, right? Which is,
no, I'm just kidding.
Yep. And I want to confess that to the 105 people who are here watching this in the live stream, and then, you know, the thousands of people who are going to download this on the Patreon feed. I no longer watch. I love Rachel Maddow dearly. I love Chris Hayes. I no longer watch the MSNBC opinion shows because I do not want OA to turn into a liberal echo chamber. And even like kind of unintentionally when it's like, oh, well, you know, Rachel Maddow thinks this is super important. I want to have my own take that's kind of fresh.
Wow.
So
that's interesting because I've never watched those. Like literally really? I've never watched. No,
I really do.
There's
really
good.
Like
I'm not,
shows.
I don't want to say that they're 100% bad, but, and there's good stuff that happens on them, but I cannot watch cable news, that kind of thing, MSNBC, CNN, that kind of thing. I cannot watch them without constantly just being annoyed at how much time wasting there is. It's all time. They got to fill that 24-hour cycle. And so there's one topic and then you bring in the screaming people and then they sit like there's so much time wasting. The commercials are god awful. It's not enough content. I'd rather just read it.
Yeah.
But sorry.
No,
I'm
with you. Serious answer to that. A couple of things. People do send me stories, sometimes in a more curated way. We have mentioned she's got a shout out on the end of the show. Deborah Smith sends me a ton. And again, not like 100, but she'll send me like 5 or 6 articles kind of every week. And since I've talked to her about it, I'll be like, look, an article doesn't do me any good unless I can find the actual underlying documents. Cause I try not to, I call it out on the show when I've had to cover a story where, you know, the actual court filing is not yet available. The premise of opening arguments is that the media sucks at reporting on the law. So
they do.
Like the Chicago. So all of that is a way to say like the Chicago Tribune is, in my view, the best opening arguments paper because they almost always will link the court document and will upload it to the Tribune website. And even when they don't, they will give the caption and then you can see like, other papers that are inferior. And again, not necessarily inferior in terms of investigative reporting. You know, like the New York Times and the Washington Post do great investigative reporting, but they will often say, like, well, the latest proceeding in Robert Mueller's investigation, whereas the Chicago Tribune will say, in, you know, in Re Valentina, you know, Maria Butina. And sometimes they'll even put the case number, and that makes it super easy. They'll either link the document or I can get onto Pacer and pull up the document. That's what I'm looking for.
Good shout out to the Chicago Tribune. That's awesome. Yeah. I had no idea, but that's how you can tell, I guess, that a source is actually maybe reporting on the law more correctly than some of the ones we see. All right, that's all we have time for. And unfortunately, I do have a hard out because of Phoebe. That's all we have time for. Thank you so much, patrons, for all the questions. They are awesome. Thank you for everybody. We had a lot more people this time. It's really fun to interact with you guys in the chat. And I wish we could do more of this. There's so many more questions, but you'll have to wait till next month.
Thank you all for coming. And we love doing this. And thank you for supporting the show.
Alrighty, see you real soon.